This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says Governor J.B. Pritzker's goal of legalizing recreational marijuana use won't help college and university leaders do their jobs.
Students who are even high-achieving students perform much lower than they were prior to that cannabis use.
Mary Cullen also reports on other college complications from legalized pot, federal funding at risk. Plus, it might be snowy out, but Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy tell you how green it can get during GLT's grow. And GLT talks with a state farm representative about the big changes of the year past and how 2019 is going to go. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois' newly sworn-in governor, J.B. Pritzker, has said he wants to legalize, tax, and regulate the sale of recreational marijuana. That move would complicate life for university leaders around Illinois and in Bloomington Normal. GLT's Mary Cullen reports.
Don't expect Illinois State University or Illinois Wesleyan University to welcome doobies, special brownies, or gummy candy with a little extra THC as well as TLC. Illinois Wesleyan Dean of Students Carla Carney Hall says cannabis use on university property will remain against the student code of conduct.
We have to be consistent with what the federal expectations are, and we would not allow marijuana on campus. So we would probably not address off-campus behavior unless it came back on campus and presented as some type of disruption or distraction or issue for us on campus.
Both Wesleyan and Illinois State accept federal funds through financial aid programs and research grants. That means no joints in the joint. ISU Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says off-university property, the atmosphere could get, well, smokier.
In terms of off-campus behavior, the code of conduct follows them wherever it's at. So at that point, the code of conduct wouldn't hold students accountable, or they wouldn't be sanctioned for cannabis use off campus.
By the way, it's not just federal student aid and research funding at issue. Woodruff notes state law bans smoking, vaping, and tobacco use on campus grounds. What college students do on their own time and away from university property is on them. But what about student athletes? ISU Athletic Director Larry Lyons says the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, includes marijuana on a list of prohibited drugs. And he says athletes have to uphold a different standard.
My preference would that cannabis not be legalized in the state of Illinois for student athletes, though I understand that the state is looking through a much bigger lens regarding this issue than just the impact on intercollegiate athletics.
Lyons says ISU Athletics now conducts random drug tests on student athletes. He says so does the NCAA, making even off-campus use problematic for athletes. ISU Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says cannabis testing is an issue in itself for everyone, not just athletes. Woodruff says pot makes drivers sluggish. Even after the high is over, he says it lingers, and no solid research shows how long it lingers in the body. The time it takes to flush cannabis out of a body depends on the THC content of the product used. Impairment symptoms and the length of impairment vary from person to person.
The immediate impairment, obviously, you can see some of the effects. There are some tests that we can do in the field to tell if somebody is too impaired. For driving, for example, we would still notice maybe some driving behaviors. They may be driving slower than the speed limit. They may still be weaving. They may fall asleep at the wheel.
Woodruff says it helps to think about THC like alcohol.
2.5 grams of an actual leafy substance is much different than 2.5 grams of a cannabis oil. So the THC content, think of it in the same way of alcohol. A beer, 12 ounces of beer is not the same thing as 12 ounces of hard liquor. The alcohol content is different for each one.
He says that's one issue the legislature will have to consider for legalization.
Just because somebody has 10 grams, that could be a reasonable amount for a leafy substance, it may be kind of an excessive amount for somebody who has an oil-based substance or even potentially some types of edibles.
10 grams is a typical cap in existing cannabis legislation.
Generally, under 10 grams was typically considered personal use amount. It would be an amount that, you know, think of it much like 2.5 might be like a joint or like a cigarette. And then so you're looking at 10 grams would be like kind of like a pack of cigarettes type idea.
Woodruff says most ISU students caught with marijuana have less than 10 grams. He says any more than that and police wonder whether an individual is selling the product. Governor Pritzker has said selling pot would remain illegal. Even setting aside legality and driving impairment, university leaders are not big fans of pot. Woodruff says the substance doesn't help students.
Students who are already low-performing students, if they are regular cannabis users, perform lower, and students who are even high-achieving students perform much lower than they would have than they were prior to that cannabis use.
Woodruff says with recreational cannabis now legalized in 10 states, research is just starting on long-term effects of cannabis use. Woodruff and Illinois Wesleyan Dean of Students Carla Carney Hall say universities can't afford to wait too long.
Anytime we look at substances of any kind on a college campus, student well-being and student success and student safety are the heart of any policy decisions related to that.
She says universities have a duty to intervene when impairment hurts student behavior.
In the case of marijuana, if a student came back and was completely disengaged in class, completely unmotivated, completely unconnected to their classroom experience, we're going to address the disconnection, and we're going to address the ways that that use is impacting their academic success.
With the lack of research on long-term THC impairment, ISU Athletics Director Larry Lyons says he cannot support legalization in use among student athletes.
I can't see where there's value from the academic side, and I don't see where there would be value on the competitive side. When an athlete is training, I don't see a value from a nutrition side. So I don't see value from legalizing cannabis and the impact on a student athlete in their particular career while they're in college.
Of course, cannabis isn't the only substance that can impact student behavior. Take alcohol, for instance. The legal drinking age comes around halfway through a traditional student college experience, and universities have dealt for decades with the many problems beer and booze bring. They say they don't like the idea much, but they would deal with the problems created by cannabis too. In fact, they already are. University Police Chief Aaron Woodruff says pot is rapidly rising as a concern, both nationally and at ISU.
With the current generation of students, there's actually been a decrease in the use of alcohol. Students are less likely to use alcohol, it seems, and it seems they're actually more likely to use cannabis.
A change in state recreational marijuana policy would impact college campuses. But local university leaders say the only benefit they see is fewer drug arrests. I'm Mary Cullen.
Illinois State University Police reported 356 drug law referrals in 2017, which includes mostly marijuana possession reports of less than 10 grams. In the same year, ISU PD referred 862 people for liquor law code of conduct issues, about two times the number of marijuana referrals.
Support for GLT comes from SEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLTs grow. 2018 was a huge year of uncertainty for people at Bloomington Normal's largest employer. State Farm insurance workers went through a lot of anxiety and turmoil as the company assessed numerous units at headquarters in Bloomington. Hundreds of workers were let go, promoted, transferred in and out. It was unsettling for the community and for the workforce. Joe Strupek is a company spokesman. He joins us to talk about where State Farm is in its gigantic reinvention and reprioritization process and where it is going.
State Farm has been going through these changes for a number of years. It's not a matter of saying that we're starting or stopping. Over the past year in Bloomington, we had some restructures and some changes with some major departments that had some local impacts. Those are beginning to take effect as we go into 2019. But I would say that long term, as we look at Bloomington and we look at the country, we will continue to change and adapt as the customer's needs do and the marketplace demands.
The scope of the changes in Bloomington has been notable. And has aroused both public attention and internal employee concern. Is the scope of that change in Bloomington Normal going to continue?
The changes that you reference and the note, we can't diminish the impacts to individuals and families and friends, and I think that's what we heard in Bloomington. But as we go into 2019, the workforce numbers have consistently been around 15,000 for the past few years. Those are going to continue. The workforce numbers have remained stable. That is the distribution of the workforce between the paraprofessional, the professional, and management are the same, with very little changes.
Let's talk about number of jobs in, number of jobs out. Assess the total picture in some metrics, would you?
We have moved employees in and out of Bloomington for a number of decades. When we had the regional office structure, at one point in time at the max, there were 28 different regional offices, and that's hundreds of offices and buildings around the country. We moved to the zone structure in 2000. Those number of buildings began to decrease, but we continued to move people in and out, and we've done it as we've gone to an enterprise-led structure. There's a misperception that the hubs were constructed to replace corporate headquarters and move folks from here to there, and that's incorrect. The reason the hubs were created was to tap into a different talent market and to bring large numbers of employees together. And so a number of those employees came from offices around the country. We've recently, within the past 2 years, announced that we're going to exit 13 of our large operation centers. And a number of those employees can compete for and go to the jobs in the hubs. So we continue to move people in and out through the career process to the hubs, just as we did in offices before. They, in relationship to size, our size has remained, as I said, relatively the same. Richardson is half the size of the corporate workforce, and each Arizona, the facility there and the one in Atlanta, is less than half the size of corporate.
So numbers in and out of Bloomington Normal.
I don't have those numbers. We don't track those. It fluctuates day in and day out.
You have been keeping track of the number of units who've been doing this reassessment and giving people hard news or good news depending on how they stack up and the needs of the company stack up, though. So you surely must have some sort of idea of the velocity of this year.
When you mention the velocity, I look at the total numbers. We look at the total numbers, and it going through 2018 and 2019 is going to remain around 15,000. The distribution of employees has remained the same. The average salary in all levels has increased.
And by how much?
It varies across. It varies across the job levels.
When you say the average salary has increased, what are you talking about there?
The average salary, the percentage has increased for all levels, paraprofessional, the professionals, and for management. There's been an increase.
By other measurements, aggregates, how do you want to slice that?
The slice it is the percentage of increase. So it varies at different levels, but it has increased across the board.
Do you have an aggregate, say the average payroll in Bloomington Normal has increased by X dollars or not?
No, I don't have that.
There's also, in addition to the overall number of people, there's a perception in the community that the top-level talent, the executive-level talent, may be diluted as part of this process, and that more of those folks will be in hubs than was the case. Can you address that?
For executives that are located here in Bloomington, we have executives located all around the country, but the number of executives in Bloomington, obviously the CEO and the C-suite is here, but for the total number, it has remained consistent for the past 8 years. The hubs aren't replacing corporate. That was not the intention. They're part of, there's 45,000 employees located outside of Bloomington. Those 45,000 used to be across hundreds of offices, and now that number of offices have decreased, and three of them are now much larger. We did that to tap a talent pool and attract portions of the workforce. We also did it because of the efficiencies of putting numbers of employees together, and that has impacted the business positively. But State Farm's corporate headquarters remains in Bloomington.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about the overall rate of pay across all sectors and all divisions in Bloomington Normal increasing. Is it a matter of it increasing more than a usual cost of living increase, or that you would say, okay, these changes to increase efficiencies and performance in the company are because we're finding better people and paying them better and concentrating our efforts on the producers? Or is it what normal business growth would suggest would happen with cost of living increases?
It's the jobs themselves. To remain competitive, we take a look at the salary ranges for jobs, and we will make adjustments to align ourselves with the marketplace. It is performance raises in combination with that. You put all those together, and that lifts the salary base.
Is it significantly above cost of living, the salary base, because you're having to adjust to the industry as a whole? Or is it, I'm trying to get to a matter of scale here, and I understand you may not have precise numbers or may not want to part with them for proprietary reasons, but go as far as you can, please.
It aligns with an increase across the board because of the jobs themselves and how those jobs price in the marketplace, but also performance evaluations as they go. We invest in employees. We want to attract and retain talent, and we compensate and provide benefits accordingly to do that. And that's for us to also remain competitive and attract that talent in the market.
Organizationally, big tech changes, market condition shifts, those prompt big adjustments to a lot of big business sectors and industries. Is the insurance industry collectively largely done with a big adjustment, or would you characterize what's happening here as an ongoing incremental adjustment that just looms large because it's concentrated in Bloomington Normal?
I think it's continual. I think for the insurance industry, the changes continue. I don't think there's a start and a stop. I think the changes that we've done from a technology standpoint, adapting to the marketplace, when you look at the customer needs, I think it's across all industries, and it's the impact to the changes outside. I don't think anybody can if we think about historically any industry. Across the country, there are skeletons of businesses that didn't change. They changed too late, or they made the wrong changes. And when those happened, those had at times impacts on the communities where they were, some more than others. So when we look at it, it's not a matter of start and stop. And I think with insurance, if you look at competitors, folks are entering the industry that haven't been in the industry before, and so the competitive landscape changes. I think we all have to react to that, and that's impacted State Farm here in Bloomington, but also all our other offices. The moves we made around the country to locations, the workforce, and the jobs was in reaction to those changes.
Contrast State Farm's approach to those changes, moving to hubs and away from regional offices and zone offices, to other insurance company efforts to do the same sort of reinvention.
I don't have knowledge of how each one of those competitors have changed. We have a distribution system that has primarily been based around the State Farm agent, and now as we've gone forward through some of these changes, it is a mixture. The consumer needs are at times they want to work with a State Farm agent, and at times they would like to do self-service. So our changes have allowed for an intermixture of that distribution system with a continual focus on the agent.
Since State Farm has a significant market share, it is probably a safe assumption to say that their customers are similar to other insurance company customers in their desires. If they really want to get service in whenever, wherever, however they want, whether it's online or through an agent or through an 800 number, how is this affecting the overall bottom line of the insurance industry and the overall infrastructure that companies have to put in place to stack up against the premium dollar, the administrative cost per premium dollar?
In the marketplace, one of the primary drivers of the choices for insurance companies is price. And so in speaking with State Farm, what we're doing is looking at more efficiencies and taking cost and expense out of the operation to compete more competitively on price. This past year, we've reduced rates all around the country. We did it in Illinois. That took Illinois. That's $65 million less in cost to the consumer. And that's where they look. And then at the time of service, it is how you respond to a claim. It is based on that customer demand. There are customers that want to talk to an agent to report a claim, and there are customers that would prefer to do that online. We don't want to limit ourselves to a customer base that just wants face-to-face contact or a customer base that wants to just do it online. We want to provide that across the board.
Industry-wide, how much is that increasing the overhead, though, if you have to have all these platforms rather than just pick one?
I don't have that information industry-wide. Okay. For a percentage.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joe Strupek of State Farm Insurance is our guest today. We're talking about the year in State Farm and trying to assess how things have shaken out in State Farm's reorganization, reprioritization over that year. Over the course of the year, there was buzz about several hundred people here, several hundred people there, people in this unit really worrying, people waiting for the shoe to drop in that unit about who would be severed and who would be asked to go somewhere else. Are we going to see the same sort of concentration on Bloomington Normal as the largest single collection of State Farm workers in the coming year? Is the pace of change going to remain the same?
What happened over the past year was focused on a number of departments that did it at the same time. When that happens, there are individuals, families who are impacted, coworkers. Those changes were concentrated in 2018. We don't see that concentration of changes going into 2019. The buzz, and we can't diminish that. Those are individual stories of impacts to people, you can't diminish that. It's individuals, it's families, and we understand that there are impacts economically to individual businesses, but collectively, as we look at McLean County, we look at Bloomington, and we look at Normal, we have remained relatively the same through the year and going into 2019.
How do you try to address the buzz? How do you try to reassure people that things aren't exactly chicken littling here?
We talk to employees. We explain the changes, and it's a repetitive process. When people are impacted, There is an emotional reaction, and we can't downplay that, and we help them as much as we can understand the direction that we're going in the organization, the changes we're making, and why we're making those changes.
Have you seen the skittishness reduce? Have you seen your reassurances take hold, or are people still pretty unsettled?
Yes. There is less buzz internally within State Farm, and there is less buzz externally. I think that you and I have talked, and I appreciate the invitation here today. And one of the reasons why I'm here today is I think that we can always improve as we talk both inside and outside to explain what these changes are and what the overall impacts are.
Well, let's talk about some of the impacts to the company. Change and reassessment is often good for an organization if it's done well. What are you seeing so far in meaningful metrics improving State Farm's ability to serve customers, as you said, wherever and whenever they want it? How are you measuring that in ways that, of course, don't violate proprietary considerations?
We report externally on an annual basis, and we'll do that again in February. But the trends that we're seeing as we go through the year is an increase in net worth. Our growth as we go through these changes is begin to move in a positive direction. We're seeing a positive impact in expenses so that we are able to make investments in other areas. We made an announcement recently, a $100 million venture operation that will look at investing in new products and services, possibly even outside the insurance industry. Those are the type of things that we're able to focus on and do. But from a metrics, we're seeing positive changes.
Tell our listeners about that investment, would you?
We're looking at how we could better serve the customer and be more competitive. So taking a look at quite possibly are there startups and other organizations that we can work with for new products, or even looking at technology and help us serve and be more competitive.
This is Sound Ideas. Joe Strupek of State Farm Insurance is our guest. We're summing up the year in change at the company headquarters in Bloomington Normal. It used to be that with the mothership being the unchallenged center for State Farm, the talent pool here was very deep. Now, that had some benefits for the community in a lot of ways. Among them, the people involved in creating community, serving on boards, councils, volunteering, fundraising, participating in cultural arts. With the hubs now taking up a significant share of talented people, can the company do anything to encourage extra involvement of its workforce in community in Bloomington Normal to offset some of that shift out?
As it relates to philanthropy and community work, today as we talk, we're just a day out from a broadcast yesterday that we did with the entire workforce, a live broadcast. It's the end of the year around the CEO. And the focus of that was State Farm's philanthropic and community efforts across the country. That's Bloomington and the hubs and the other locations that we have. And through multiple programs, the matching gift program that we have where for a qualified tax deductible gift, State Farm will match up to $1,500, up to $3,000 for an educational institute. We have the Good Neighbor Grant program where employees will volunteer 40 hours to an organization and we will give $500 to that organization. That has remained consistent across the company, the participation. We've seen increases in giving with the matching gift. It is not something that is that we take lightly. You have 19,000 State Farm agents that are engaged in the community. Yesterday, in addition to the nonprofits in what would be the hub cities and also Bloomington, we highlighted our participation in places like Winter Haven, Florida, and DuPont, Washington. People in the employees in Bloomington continue to serve on boards. We're seeing a similar participation dollar-wise and volunteer-wise in groups as with the Good Neighbor grants and the matching gifts. And we continue to promote that. We have employees that sit on both the Bloomington and Normal Town Councils. There are employees that continue to participate in the boards of Unit 5 and District 87. So we continue to promote that. We have not seen, from our perspective, a difference. We don't track by individual that participation, but I think there's a very strong connection between the workforce here in Bloomington and the nonprofits and the community.
The theory is that connection is going to be eroded by the hub system, that the change company structure creates a different dynamic for community involvement from the way things used to be done. It used to be send them out to a regional for a few years, bring them back when they're promotable, back out, back here, rinse and repeat till career peak. And they would form ties here at each iteration of their employment within Bloomington Normal, and they would pick up those ties when they came back. If they're not coming back, why get involved? Why view this place as home and a place to be involved? And sometimes this isn't their end destination. If they want to be in a hub, they're going to want to stay in a hub, and they're going to develop ties there and involvements there. Will they be less inclined to get involved in Bloomington Normal along the way to their career goals?
They're still coming back, and that that Bloomington to the hubs or other locations in the country, that will continue. The hubs weren't designed to be a final destination for State Farm employees. And to not have talent housed here. So instead of somebody moving from Bloomington to a regional office and back again and back to another regional office and back, you will see, and we have had experience where somebody goes to a hub and they come back to Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
They go to another hub and they come back to Bloomington. So it's remaining the same.
Mayor Chris Cousteau of Normal said recently on our air that he doesn't think that the transfers in and out are as numerous as they used to be, that the pace of that, the velocity, if you will, has slowed compared to 15 years ago. And certainly the realty market would support that, although that's a cloudy tool because there are other factors affecting the realty market. So what's your take on and your assessment of how much transfer period is compared to what it was 10 years ago?
We don't track the velocity. I would not be able to speak to the increase or decrease in activity, and that would go that would fluctuate based on at the time what the needs were, where somebody needed to be, the talent alignment. But that will continue. Even though there may be less going in and out, our footprint here and our relationship with the community is relatively the same, and that includes all level. And we continue to encourage folks to be involved in the community.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. I'm Charlie Schlinker. With us is Joe Strupik of State Farm Insurance. Let's talk about the downtown building in Bloomington. Prospects, Nibbles, where are you on trying to unload that landmark?
We're continuing to market. We continue to have interest, and we're still in that process.
What's the company's goal for it now that the initial marketing period has shaken out? Are you still looking for a single buyer or a consortium? How much are you willing to look for multiple buyers rather than one to get a sale? What's your process?
We're looking at all the options. We haven't limited to any particular individual or consortium. We're marketing the building, and we are open to consideration of any option.
How many Nibbles have you had?
That I can't share.
So are you close to changing your intentions about going to a different different disposition of that building or giving it away? Or
we're still looking at the sale of the building, and we're still talking to buyers about that.
The city has said it would really like to help with this. Have you involved them? What is their ability to facilitate a sale?
We have had conversations with the city all along through the process. And have talked to them and are looking at all options for the disposition of the building.
And how can they help?
Specifically, we're having conversations with them on all of that, and that's a conversation between us and the city.
State Farm Public Affairs spokesman Joe Strupek talked with GLT about the year past and the year ahead for Bloomington Normal's largest employer. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is GLT.
Today's morning routine was just like yesterday's. Same toothpaste, same breakfast. But what was happening in the world outside your door was anything but ordinary. Progress, unrest, lives changed forever. Every weekday starts out the same until you listen. Turn on Morning Edition and the world will open up before your ears in a way that opens your eyes. Start every day fully awake with Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting Little Women, following the lives, loves, and tribulations of sisters growing up during the Civil War, based on the classic novel, running two weekends in January. Details and tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear what directions landscaping and gardening might take in the new year in this episode of our gardening podcast, Grow. GLT's Mike McCurdy talks with ISU's Patrick Murphy about new trends.
Now is the time to begin thinking about what you want out of your garden and landscape, and there are some 2019 trends you might want to think about. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, how are you?
Great to be with you, Mike.
So 2019 trends, what's old is new again in some cases, or are we talking about new things?
I think we're talking about new things and new combinations of existing things. And this is according to a lot of hotshot landscape architects and landscape designers that are published in some of my favorite periodicals.
So one of the trends is to sort of shake it up, surprise with unexpected elements. How do we do that?
Well, they have some great points, and one of the great points is to just keep it low maintenance. Maintain a landscape that is planned with a maintenance level in mind. I think that even real estate trends suggest that people are looking for something that they can spend less time working on and more time living with and gazing upon. So low maintenance is everything from replacing annuals with perennials, removal of messy plants near walkways, drives, water features. So oak trees are great, but if it's dropping acorns on your driveway, that's maybe time to consider replacing that tree with one or more new trees. Irrigation kits are really hot and fashionable because they're lightweight and they're becoming less and less expensive and easier to install. And then landscape materials. There's all kinds of new stuff out there.
Well, what about containers?
Containers, the deal with the containers, Mike, is that you can incorporate edibles into your landscape and your garden with containers. Containers can also be used to kind of bring the outdoors in by using the containers that rest on the floor that are large enough to maybe introduce a small ornamental interior tropical tree, you know, like a ficus or a rubber tree or something like that.
Edible landscapes can't, that's not something new, but is it sort of reemerging as a trend?
I think it's coming up as a way to have everything. That's kind of the new idea, have everything. Not just the edible landscape, but the edible landscape that can be beautiful and low maintenance and built to last and, you know, something that you can share so it has some civic enhancement to it.
When it comes to containers and herbs, they don't actually have to be in what you would think of as a traditional container like a pot. You could do a vertical garden.
Vertical gardens are super popular. You know, space is a commodity, and pilots, they're a great holders of soil, and they're manageable, so you could pick it up and move it out of the way. You could paint it and make it attractive, matching some of the furniture or some of the landscape itself. But the idea there is to bring things up, and you know, you're still roots down, leaves up, even in a vertical situation there.
So, side digression here. Any ideas for late season cilantro? My cilantro is always sort of going to seed by the time I actually need it to can the salsa with the later season tomatoes.
Yeah, maybe divide a batch, maybe band the batches in so that they're replacing annuals, you know, because they can spread and give you some nice clumpy coverage.
You mentioned different kinds of materials. What did you mean by that?
So nowadays there are landscaping blocks that are coated with kind of like a polymer, and they don't fade in the sun. They're actually a little bit lighter than the old school precast concrete stuff. So it's still really neat.
Talking about some hardscape.
These are hardscape items, but then there's even I'm always been a big fan of glass. I've always liked glass, and you've seen it in your fire pits, you know, you've seen it in the fish tank. Well, now the industrial and institutional byproduct of commercial glass is becoming available in like 60-pound bags. If you live in the right conditions, hot and sunny, not lots of leaves falling, or an area that's just open and away from trees, it's a really interesting ground cover. It replaces your river rocks and your rockwood nuggets and things like that.
What is garden sharing?
Garden sharing is when, if anybody's ever had a garden, it's hard to eat every single thing that you grow. And with the new ideas of mixing containers into the landscape, inside and out, and also, like I mentioned, colonizing with some of the edibles, not just sprinkling them in. Maybe you've got a whole big bunch of plants that are producing vegetables. Share them with the local food pantry. Face-to-face charity is one of my favorites. You know, great way to stay in the good graces of your neighbors and close friends is to share with them.
Can you just plant enough that wildlife can benefit as well? Maybe, you know, if you plant enough and the squirrel grabs a tomato, so what?
That's a great way to go, too. And I think that takes a lot of the stress over having the garden, right? So a couple tomatoes hit the ground, you know, no hard feelings. Go golfing, go fishing. I just think that most people have a lot more than they would expect, at least as far as what they can eat all at one time.
So you touched on bringing the outdoors indoors with plants, and I'll ask you a question about that in a moment, but let's talk about bringing the indoors outdoors with furniture.
The ideas that are newer there is to really make it count. So there's no bias here at Grow Corporate against the folding lawn chairs. You know, those are helpful. You got to have those. All of a sudden, a bunch of people show up. But for the household itself, you know, 2 to 4 people, let's say, you know, family size element, let's have some really comfortable, sturdy, long-lasting, ergonomically comfortable, vibrant furniture. You know, just like the stuff you encounter when you go on vacation. And set it up in the same manner, too.
And I suppose in the long run, it pays to spend a little bit more for the quality.
Yeah, and then there's even a way to get around that, because frugality is a virtue. It's very simple to go online and get the plans for Adirondack chairs, for example, for the beach surf chairs. You can build these yourself out of stuff that you might even be able to scrounge off the curb. Yeah,
like a pallet.
Yeah, maybe. A pallet. Yeah. One by stock and two by stock are routinely thrown away during household projects, and you might be able to do the world a big favor and scrounge up some of that for repurposing.
And then work to maybe coordinate it with the color of the house or the decor
right. Inside.
Bring the really sort of
if you have a say you have a shady garden and it's all light colors and the mint greens and chartreuse. Might be a good idea to paint the furniture that same color, too, so that you have some of those, I've heard it described as color echoes that repeat. And that's what we see when we go on vacation, make no mistake about it. Or you look out into kind of a dreary backyard and there's some bright orange chairs out there. Well, that's clearly a attention-seeking behavior
right.
That's drawing you out to the chairs.
And then bringing the outdoors to the indoors, you talked about growing herbs inside. It could go a lot further than that.
Yeah, and again, when the conditions are right, you might be able to get some blueberries or some raspberries growing in a pot on your sunroom. You know, southwest exposure, lots of light. Lots of care, a little more care goes involved with growing produce, vegetables in containers. I think there's more work involved there than there is in the ground.
There are plants you can grow indoors that help clean the air better than other plants?
Yeah, I think that all plants clean the air, but there's the notorious spider plant and there's the pothos. These are all plants that have an attractive leaf surface. They're tropical house plants, if you will. You do have to do a little maintenance and keep the dust off of them because that's one of the ways they help clean the air. They're also doing air exchange. So those are good examples of plants that you can incorporate for that. Jade, you know, if you wanted some big fleshy thing sitting in a pot on the floor like a garden pond, that'd be a good plant for that.
If you have questions about your garden or landscaping, now is the time to speak up. We sometimes get busy in the spring with lots of questions, so send them in now at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about wellness for the gardener. I assume this goes beyond simply protecting your knees with a knee pad.
There's a lot more to it than that.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to Grow at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Okay, the inauguration is over. Maroon 5 has packed its instruments after the inaugural party. J.B. Pritzker is the governor. Now what? IPR's Daisy Contreras reports on how Pritzker has set the stage for his agenda and how Republicans are receiving it.
It was a good day to be a Democrat in Illinois, filled with concert-like music performances, accompanied by dancing from those in the audience. The atmosphere was jovial. Democratic State Representative Sue Scheer of Decatur channeled that excitement.
Oh, it's all exciting and everyone's smiling and hopeful, and I feel very hopeful that we have a bright tomorrow.
But as the festivities died down and the 101st legislative session gets underway, Pritzker must work with Republicans, even in a Democratic majority, to get what he calls his agenda for the working people of Illinois. This includes a $15 minimum wage, commercializing the use of recreational marijuana, and enacting a balanced budget. Speaking from an Illinois-shaped stage made specially for the occasion, Pritzker promised to work on behalf of those hurt the hardest by the two-year budget impasse.
But be clear about this. I won't balance the budget on the backs of the starving, the sick, and the suffering.
And as heard throughout the campaign, he emphasized the need for a new graduated tax system, where higher income levels are taxed at higher rates. He says the future of Illinois depends on it.
Now, I'm not naive about what it will take to do this. All who enter a discussion about our state's budget and a fair tax system in good faith will be welcome to the table. But if you lead with partisanship and scare tactics, you will be met with considerable political will.
Some Republicans are leery of Pritzker's graduated income tax proposal, saying it would only hurt the middle class. Republican State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield says the focus ought to be on stopping economic decline and people leaving Illinois.
When we continue to see people move out of state at a rapid pace, we need to address this situation. And that's a combination of the economic climate and the tax structure in the state of Illinois.
Pritzker also promises to focus on workers' rights.
Working men and women deserve to have a governor and a Department of Labor that will enforce laws protecting workers' wages and workers' rights. And they deserve a $15 minimum wage. It's good for the working families of Illinois and good for our economy.
Former Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed a proposal to raising the minimum wage in 2017, saying the hike would hurt small businesses. Several Republicans have voiced similar concerns. Senate Republican leader Bill Brady of Bloomington says while Democrats have the majority, passing key legislation that's good for the state will still require working across the aisle.
The Democrats, I don't think on and of their own, want to necessarily just deal with ramrodding their policies through. So we can be helpful. We are here to be opposed in some ways, but supportive in others.
there was an overall feeling of unity from within the convention center where the inauguration took place, but some on the outside are less enthusiastic. Not long after Pritzker was sworn in, Illinois GOP Chairman Tim Snyder sent out a statement signaling a clear partisan divide. He says Republicans will hold, quote, all Democrats accountable for their false promises because we know that they are the main culprits behind Illinois' fiscal demise. Despite that bit of shade, Democrats remained jubilant. The crowd seemed particularly excited about the new Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. She's the first African-American to serve in that office, and talked about the history that led to that moment.
With the DNA of my formerly enslaved great-great-grandfather, William Stevens, as part of my genetic makeup, I am proud to stand before you as our state's first Black Lieutenant Governor.
Stratton, along with Attorney General Kwame Raoul, Secretary of State Jesse White, and Comptroller Susana Mendoza mean that Illinois has its first ever majority-minority cabinet. Pritzker says he'll be working to include all of Illinois' diverse voices in his administration. I'm Daisy Contreras.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Mary Cullen, Mike McCurdy, and Patrick Murphy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One.